Pensionen, Gehältern, mit den Korrespondenzen, jenen Alltagsdingen, wie Alexei Alexandrowitsch das nannte, die so viel Zeit kosteten. Dann folgten persönliche Dinge, der Besuch des Arztes und des Ökonomen. Der Ökonom nahm nicht viel Zeit in Anspruch. Er händigte Alexei Alexandrowitsch lediglich das benötigte Geld ein und legte kurz Rechenschaft ab über den Stand der Dinge, der nicht so gut war. Denn wie sich ergab, war in diesem Jahr aufgrund häufiger Ausfahrten mehr verbraucht worden und herrschte ein Defizit. Der Arzt aber, ein berühmter Petersburger Arzt, der zu Alexei Alexandrowitsch in freundschaftlicher Beziehung stand, nahm viel Zeit in Anspruch. Alexei Alexandrowitsch hatte ihn nicht erwartet und war verwundert über seinen Besuch und mehr noch darüber, dass der Arzt ihn sehr eingehend nach seinem Zustand befragte, ihm die Brust abhorchte, ihn abklopfte und die Leber abtastete. Alexei Alexandrowitsch wusste nicht, dass seine Freundin Lydia Iwanowna bemerkt hatte, dass Alexei Alexandrowitschs Gesundheit dieses Jahr nicht in Ordnung war und den Arzt gebeten hatte, vorbeizufahren und den Kranken zu untersuchen. »Tun Sie es für mich«, hatte Gräfin Lydia Iwanowna zu ihm gesagt. »Ich tue es für Russland, Gräfin«, hatte der Arzt geantwortet. »Ein unschätzbarer Mann«, hatte Gräfin Lydia Iwanowna gesagt. Der Arzt war sehr unzufrieden mit Alexei Alexandrowitsch. Er fand die Leber erheblich vergrößert, die Nahrungsaufnahme verringert und die Badekur ohne Wirkung. Er verordnete möglichst viel körperliche Bewegung und möglichst wenig geistige Anspannung und vor allem keinerlei Verdruss, also genau das, was für Alexei Alexandrowitsch ebenso unmöglich war, wie nicht zu atmen. Und als er ging, ließ er Alexei Alexandrowitsch in dem unangenehmen Bewusstsein zurück, irgendetwas sei nicht in Ordnung in ihm und könne auch nicht wiederhergestellt werden.
Thank you. so brilliantly written by Babyface.
That was Beverly Knight talking about Whitney Houston, who died last night. The weather, there'll be more outbreaks of light rain and drizzle across the United Kingdom this afternoon. Studio production was by Nick Buckley. The editor was Brooks Douglas. I'm Edward Sturton, and that is The World This Weekend.
In a minute, Alan Little concludes his series, which looks at the key moments and issues which brought the EU to the current crisis. That's after this.
Mr. Bond, you returned with all the tedious inevitability of an unloved season.
The Bond was. Shawada, wada.
My best impression. Yikes, school! And when I say best, I mean only.
The famous French mime Marcel Marceau. That was him trying to get out of a box.
I do a pretty good Mouth of Sauron from Return of the King. The halfling was dear to you.
This is me, Clive Anderson, saying goodnight, goodnight.
The home of radio comedy. BBC Radio 4.
We're quite funny.
In half an hour, how to perk up a droopy bouquet and warding off the white rot. Two questions answered in Gardener's Question Time at 2 o'clock. But now on Radio 4, the final part of Europe's Choice. Today, Alan Little looks at how the current crisis might affect the future of the European Union.
This is what the Greek government faces in their attempts to impose austerity on the Greek people. Another day of action, another general strike by public sector workers has brought the country to a standstill. Already several thousand demonstrators have gathered here near the National Museum for a march down to Constitution Square and the country's parliament. But this is not just a revolt by Greeks against their own government. It's also a revolt by Greece itself against Europe. Because the demonstrators here had the added argument that the Prime Minister they blame for imposing austerity was not chosen by Greeks themselves, but was chosen by other European powers and principally Germany.
Germany is the one that's the locomotive of paying for other people's problems. They will probably ask to have a much bigger say in what's happening in Greece and Italy and Spain.
Peter Doukas is a former Greek budget minister. The EU was conceived, in part at least, as a way of addressing the problem of Germany's mighty weight in Europe. Integration was, its leaders thought, a way to normalise, to Europeanise Germany. Is this crisis in the Eurozone having the opposite effect of Germanising much of Europe?
Decisions will be made by those who actually pay for the biggest part of the bill. So the center of gravity of Europe is rapidly moving towards Berlin.
So do you think this kind of Germanization of Europe taking place?
Well, first of all, we had a customs union that benefited Germany because it could export its competitive products freely. And then you had the monetary union, and now you have a fiscal union. And in the fiscal union, they will be the ones dictating the terms with France as a junior partner.
European opinion is fragmenting. Half the continent now thinks Germany has grown too powerful. Greek television casually portrays a caricature Angela Merkel strutting around the Parthenon dressed as Hitler. But the other half thinks Germany is not aggressive enough and that German inaction is now an existential threat to the single currency. Is the euro bleeding to death because Germany will not allow the European Central Bank to intervene on the scale that's now urgently needed? France has always wanted a much more interventionist ECB. Ed Balls, the Shadow Chancellor, as an advisor to Gordon Brown, played a key role in keeping Britain out of the euro.
If you have a body on the floor bleeding, every hour of blood loss makes the patient weaker. There's not much point in the European Central Bank or certain leaders giving, you know, the kind of troubled patient a lecture about the fitness regime they should have had for the previous 10 years. And this massive doubt has been created about whether the commitment is real and 100%. And you can't make a monetary union work in those circumstances.
What are the main impediments to the ECB acting in the way that you believe it should act?
The ECB doesn't feel as though it has the political support of its major and most powerful shareholders, and therefore it is hamstrung and hampered from doing what is necessary.
To be clear, is it German reluctance to go down that road?
Well, it is very clear that that is what the French have wanted. But you have to reach a collective agreement, and it's not been possible because I don't think that Germany and others have been willing to sign up to that view of what needs to be done. But without that, you can't make this monetary union work.
Germany is in a position today where it is, like it or not, and the truth is it doesn't like it, in the driving seat of the European Union. Germany's never wanted to be in the driving seat. My memories of Germany in Brussels over 20 years or more is a country that was always utterly incompetent in punching its weight.
For no one is more spooked by the idea of German supremacy in Europe, by the historical resonance of that, than the Germans themselves. Quentin Peel of the Financial Times in Berlin is a veteran Europe watcher.
It goes back to the very federal German system. You have a devolution of power and a coalition system of government, which by definition means weak government. And Germans like weak government. It's not what they had in the 1930s, anything not to be back in the 30s. And I remember going to see the German ambassador in Brussels back in the 1980s. And I said, Ambassador, I really want to understand what your position is on reforming the common agricultural policy. And he said, Herr Peel, I would like to understand that too.
The European leaders who built the EU were driven by their experience of the most destructive war in human history. They wanted to answer Europe's German question. How do we stop it happening a third time? They succeeded. But there is a new, younger Germany now. This Germany resents the assumption that it'll be Europe's paymaster, endlessly picking up bills run up by feckless and ill-disciplined neighbours. The historian Timothy Garton-Ash.
The problem is that the consensus which was there 20 years ago, or even 10 years ago, for making this work by moving forward to closer union is no longer there in Germany, because Germany has become a more normal country, like France or Britain.
We see clearly in polling now today that many Germans are either disappointed from Europe, or confused, or both.
Ulrike Gero of the European Council on Foreign Relations, based in Berlin.
You have a new generation of the, let's call it the 30-something people, who are now going into the ministries, going into the media, and they have just a different narrative. You have basically still a very pro-European Germany, but a Germany that puts a price tag behind Europe. I'm still from a generation without price tag, which is Europe at any price, any condition, good for us, glue of history. This is gone. Germany is still European, but with a price tag. What Europe at which price?
Almost everywhere, the crisis has provoked greater suspicion of the idea of Europe. A retreat to the nations, and not just in Greece and Germany. If I'd been making this program even 5 years ago, I'd have gone to Turkey to consider where Europe ends geographically. Turkey first applied for membership 40 years ago. But does our common European home really stretch to the borders of Iran and Iraq, to the Euphrates Valley and the fringes of Babylon? The question seems dated now. Turkey is moving on. Sinan Ulgan is a former member of the Turkish delegation to the EU.
At the time, opinion polls were showing a support of almost 75%. Since 2004, what we have seen is a gradual but clear decline in domestic support for EU membership. Today, we have, according to, you know, to the opinion polls, we have about between 35 and 40% support for EU membership. So there's been a slide of almost 35 basis points.
The economic benefits of membership for Turkey are now in doubt. Over the last 10 years, Turkey's economy has grown by an average of 5% a year. Per capita income has tripled. It's now the world's 16th largest economy. In the Arab Spring, Turkey is seen as a political model to emulate, a successful fusion of Muslim and democratic sensibilities. Turkey is turning its back on a European future and forging links with a world familiar to previous generations of Turks, the Ottomans. Turkey is drawing closer to its old imperial territories.
Turkish policymakers don't like to use the term of neo-Ottomanism because it has imperial connotations. However, when you look at what's happening in practice, it is difficult to argue against that. when you look at where Turkey wants to grow its influence, it happens to coincide with the Ottoman geography. But obviously, another explanation is that really Turkey was able to take advantage of two trends in this geography. One is rising anti-Americanism after the war in Iraq. And two is really the lack of a true Arab leadership. And possibly a third one is the still the continuing ineffectiveness of the EU as a foreign policy actor.
And so the shape of future Europe is shifting. In the beginning, Germany and France married their fortunes together. The European project was designed to protect German industry and French agriculture, and it served that purpose well. But that was when Germany was West Germany, with its little provincial capital at Bonn, close to the Belgian border. That Germany was easy for France to embrace.
Yeah, this is the craft shop for the mattresses, the high-temperature mattresses.
In a suburb of Berlin, the capital of a reunited Germany, Caroline Beck is the director of a family company founded by her great-grandfather in 1874. Today, they make heat insulation equipment for power plants, amongst other things. She's one of Germany's prodigious, prolific exporters.
I would say more than 70% of my business is foreign business now.
You don't just mean not German, you mean
not German,
not European?
Not German, not European. South America, Asia, Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, all the Stan countries.
Germany is the world's second largest exporter. Exports account for a third of the country's output. And most of its exports are sold inside the EU. So Germany is probably the biggest single beneficiary of the single market and currency. But Berlin is emphatically not West Germany. It is Prussia. It faces east, beyond Europe's borders. The Germany that France married in 1957 didn't include this, wasn't nearly so eastern.
Ukraine and Russia, because it's near. It's near to our mentality. Yeah, as a Berlin company, there was always a Moscow-Berlin relationship. Two-thirds of my stuff comes from Eastern German. And this is why we started in Russia. Because at that time, China was too far away.
So you felt naturally at home in a community composed
of
Russians,
yeah,
Ukrainians?
Yeah, sort of. I think I can understand the Russians better than I could probably understand the Chinese.
Or the French?
Much better than the French, definitely.
Why?
We are very close to the East here in Berlin. I'm sure that my grandparents came from, I don't know, Poland or Russia or somewhere around the area. I don't know, but I think so.
How important will Europe be in the future to your business plans?
Not important at all. Sorry to say.
In the ashes of its lost war, Germany emerged to build Europe's strongest economy. It did it on the solid rocks of fiscal discipline and a sound currency. The Germans are not alone in believing that they are being punished for their own success and prudence. Finland suffered a devastating recession in the early 1990s. They did not riot, they did not strike, they did not take bailouts from Brussels. They took their self-prescribed austerity medicine and turned their fortunes around.
We are trying to go into the government. We will negotiate with the other parties who are coming into coalition what should be the future of the European Union.
In their recent general election, a nationalist party called the True Finns took 20% of the seats in Parliament. Their message was this: why should our currency be put at risk by the behaviour of nations who did not share our pain, who chose the easy spendthrift path? Sampo Terho is a True Finn member of the European Parliament. He says Finland made the mistake of joining the euro in a short-lived fit of naive optimism after the fall of the Soviet Union, when Finland, until then constrained by its Russian neighbour, was free at last to join the Western European mainstream.
Finland was in a sort of euphoric state.
Euphoric.
Yeah, that's right. It was sort of a great relief to finally go to the West and join everything we could. And for years and years, we were the yes men of EU, the nice guys who always wanted just to be in the core, no matter what the cost. Now, for the first time after the elections, we have started to use the word no in the EU circles, and that has caused some eyebrows to lift.
And what are you saying no to?
We are saying no to the federalism. We are saying no to giving up our independence, our sovereignty, to this, well, monster of a bureaucracy. As we all know, the Commission hasn't got a single member who is democratically elected. As we have now seen during this crisis, it is the Commission who is getting most of the powers that are now given to EU. And that is really worrying from our view. Of course, we appreciate the peace project and the things we can achieve economically and environmentally and all that cooperation that EU was made for originally. But we have went too far. We have went too far and too fast.
The European achievement has been remarkable. Europe has had 70 years not only of free trade and steadily rising standards of living, not only of peace, but of a peace in which war is now all but unimaginable. But public opinion has often followed the van of European integration reluctantly and at a distance. Now integration has run up against a powerful foe, a democratic backlash, a revolt of the nations, even in its Franco-German core. Timothy Garton-Ash.
There is self-evidently a popular revolt against the way the European project has developed. And politicians have neglected for far too long to make the case for this project to their own public opinion. It's not going to be made up by having a better European Parliament or a directly elected European Commission president. I simply don't believe it. There is no united European public opinion. There are virtually no European media. We speak different languages. We live in different mental worlds. We're not suddenly going to feel, oh, that's all right, because we voted for John Smith as Commission president.
It was always a project devised by elites, starting with Jean Monnet, but which, with the exception perhaps of Britain and a bit one or two Scandinavian countries, did have popular support.
Sir Stephen Wall was a chief advisor on Europe to successive British governments and a renowned British European.
Here you have a group of 27 countries who, without some mechanism to unite them, A, would be very quarrelsome on trade and economic issues. That's the negative side of it. On the positive side of it, we are all democracies. We do have some shared values. And I think that in terms of trade policy and aid policy and its political stance generally, the European Union is a power for good in the world. Now, that doesn't deal with your fundamental question of how then do you get popular buy-in for it, except that I suppose you could argue that now, as in the past, if it actually delivers in terms of economic prosperity, then people will be less worried about the democratic deficit.
It's a bit like China.
Yeah, it's a little bit. Don't take that analogy too far, because it's not undemocratic. I mean, the decisions are being taken by ministers, all of whom are democratically elected. They are mandated by their parliaments.
Yes, but those democratically elected parliaments, how much power will they have in the Europe that emerges from this crisis? Almost certainly, national budgets in the Eurozone will in the future have to be submitted to Brussels for approval. Won't national populations start to say, wait a minute, this government we've elected, is it accountable down the way to us or upwards to Brussels, to an institution we haven't elected? The Finns are already saying it.
In the beginning of the 90s, we had a huge depression. We were almost in a similar shape than Greece or Portugal now. During that time, thank God, we still had our own currency. We devalued it and did a lot of savings. And in the end, we pulled through Europe.
You're one of the richest countries in Europe.
Yes, at the moment, yes.
But do you accept that if you're in a single currency, you have certain responsibilities to the people you share, the nations you share that currency with?
Now, that is the big question. How could they sell this idea to the Finnish people in the first place and to the peoples of Europe in the first place that we should join the euro? Part of the deal was that we do not have any sort of bailout policy. It was clearly said in the EU treaties. As we broke this fundamental rule, then we broke the original euro system.
The economic imperative is for more Europe, more fiscal discipline imposed by Brussels. There is a political backlash to this, a resistance by some of the nations, but not all.
Every time I
come to Berlin, every time I see the Brandenburg Gate, I always remember the night in November in 1989 when I drove up here from Warsaw with an American journalist called Anne Applebaum. We actually arrived here in the east, then crossed Checkpoint Charlie to the other side.
Radoslav Sikorski was, in 1989, a young journalist working for the Sunday Telegraph. He's now Poland's foreign minister and one of the most interesting politicians on the continent. This is him speaking in Berlin in November. In the context of the history of these two countries, it's a remarkable speech.
I will probably be the first Polish foreign minister in history to say so, but here it is anyway. I fear German power less than I'm beginning to fear German inactivity.
Think of it. A Polish foreign minister in Berlin urging Germany to throw its weight around in Europe. It was as though he was saying, we've got over the Nazi nightmare, so should you.
I think it was a statement of Poland's new confidence. As you know, there is plenty of history between us and Germany. But we have carried out a successful transformation from dictatorship to democracy and from a command economy to a market economy that survived the recent crisis without a recession. So we now have the confidence to tell the Germans what their responsibility in the current situation is, and that as the biggest economy on the continent and the biggest beneficiary of the current arrangements, they have the biggest duty to do something about it.
In Poland has emerged with a stronger and stronger voice almost every year now in Europe. It's becoming more influential, more important. The center of gravity is moving to the east. How do you see Poland's role in Europe changing in the years that lie ahead?
Well, without moving our borders for once, we have moved from Eastern Europe 30 years ago to being Central Europe a decade ago to now becoming Northern Europe in terms of our financial policies, our business culture. But you should also remember that Poland has a historic memory of itself as a largish regional country. We like to think that we've had a bad patch for a couple of hundred years and that we are only now simply returning to what used to be.
Radoslav Sikorski is an Anglophile. He was Oxford-educated, admired Margaret Thatcher. In Britain, he would be a natural Tory. But he laments the Euroscepticism of his Tory friends in the UK. This was his caution to Britain in that Berlin speech.
Your total sovereign, corporate and household debt exceeds 400% of GDP. Are you sure markets will always favour you? We would prefer you in. But if you can't join, please allow us to forge ahead. And please start explaining to your people that European decisions are not Brussels diktats, but agreements in which you freely participate.
What has Poland reached in the last 10, 15 years? Let's say a top status of the economy, of political stability. Poland is, let's say, in the heart of Europe.
Joachim Bitterlich was a senior foreign policy advisor to Chancellor Helmut Kohl and one of the architects of the single currency.
The European Union, since its inception, has been founded on the relationship between Germany and France. You can imagine in the future the German-Polish relationship becoming more important than the yes. Franco-German relationship.
Perhaps yes, perhaps as important, because if you take the free, there you see the mirror of Europe and at the same time the backbone. The French, in my eyes, underestimate the importance of Poland till today. The Germans, I think, Berlin has understood it. If you want one of the advantages of being in Berlin, is that relationship.
The single currency was designed to stop nations gaining an unfair advantage by devaluing. Germany has been the great beneficiary of what the Treaty of Rome called ever closer union. The true Finns are now flying a conspiracy kite that European federalists will use the current crisis as a way of binding the nations of Europe more tightly together. In fact, they're starting to say maybe that's been the plan all along, the purpose of the current crisis.
Is it really possible that they did not see the problems of the Greeks? I've heard from a very reliable source the problems of the Greeks and even the tampering of the numbers was widely known in here, Europarliament, and it was just ignored because it didn't fit the image that the euro system is perfect. Now when the crisis is here, the federalists are not willing to take one single step backwards. They are trying to advance the integration even further because of the crisis.
So they're using the crisis in order to push forward the federalist project.
Exactly. That makes me think, how far was the original euro system an unintentional failure? Was it a deliberate plan to create the United States of Europe at any cost?
It is a seductive conspiracy theory with a powerful appeal among those already inclined to Euroscepticism. You hear this in Athens everywhere, that the euro crisis is a manufactured emergency to allow foreign capitalists to pillage the country's assets. It is a Greek revolt against the European ideal. Paradoxically, Ed Balls claims he was against the euro, in part at least, because he believed it would, in the long run, damage, not strengthen the European project.
I was always, and have always been, a strong pro-European. My view was that the potential stress this would mean for the European project was big and risky, but my view for Britain was always that pro-Europeanism here was too fragile to deal with the potential stress and shock of our membership. So far from being a sceptic argument about Britain's relationship with Europe, my argument was always that the pro-European cause could potentially be set back for a generation if we got this wrong. That's why it had to be preceded with great caution. I think actually that is an argument which history may show should have been applied to the whole of the European Union. We'll see. We'll see. Maybe they'll come through this.
For this is an existential crisis in Europe. The single currency is in danger of unravelling. Quentin Peel.
Crises in Europe do eventually, finally force people to respond and try and find a solution. The financial crisis that we've got now is that sort of shock to the system. Urgent measures are needed now to prove to the markets that Europe's got an answer to the problem of not having a fiscal union. Can we do it in a matter of 6 months or even 2 to 3 months? I don't know. I don't know if it's going to work. I mean, as somebody who's always been fascinated by this project and has always believed that actually it was a really exciting project that was going on in Europe, I have real concern that it is a moment when it could fall apart. There is a possibility of that.
Europe's elites want more Europe, not less. They want Germany to act, to help impose its legendary discipline on the rest of the continent. Given its history, Germany is squeamish about imposing anything. Lord Kerr, the former British ambassador to the EU.
For them, it's really important to internationalise the controls. They don't want Germans to be seen as controllers. They generally don't want to control, in my view. I think it's not just perceptions, it's reality. But that drives them to wanting a bigger Brussels. And that is not popular in Paris, and clearly very unpopular in Britain.
The Eurozone now faces a clear choice: force some countries to drop out of the single currency and retreat to national silos, or lock more tightly together and surrender more sovereignty, especially over tax and spending, to Brussels. The choice it makes will be made, in effect, in Berlin. The project began in the 1950s as a way of Europeanizing Germany. Half a century on, the fate of the continent lies in the hands of a reluctant German chancellor.
Europe's Choice was presented by Alan Little and produced by Jane Beresford.
Everything begins with a question.
Why did you lie about your age?
Why do you think?
And the questions are just beginning.
Oh, some of the boys had too much, myself included, I must admit. You know how it is.
How it is? No, sorry, Rod, I'm afraid we don't know.
The Interrogation. Three crime stories probing some of today's most complex moral issues.
Was Rod Tyler aware of how old you were?
I told him I was 18. It wasn't his fault.
What wasn't his fault?
Kenneth Cranham and Alex Lanapeken star as unlikely partners in The Interrogation. Original British drama on BBC Radio 4, starting tomorrow afternoon at 2:15.
some sympathy. It's the same old story of a man in a search for glory, and he found it there underneath the bottle. Things are never good, things go from bad to weird. Hey, give me another scotch with my beer. I'm sad to say I feel the same today as I always do. Give me a drink to relax me. Ooh-wee, liquor set me free. I can't do no work, the shakes inside me. Ah, shucks, I've got the lousiest luck. I'm sick of this underneath the bottle. 7 days make a week, on two of them I sleep. I can't remember what the heck I was doing. I got bruises on my leg from I can't remember when. I fell down some stairs, I was lying underneath the bottle. Ooh-wee, son of a bee. So down, you can't get any lower. So long, world, you played too rough, and it's getting me all mixed up. I lost my pride, and it's hiding there underneath the bottle.
He eats up script kiddies for breakfast, I heard. He drives the open source train, and his currency is uptime. Please welcome, with a very warm applause, Julian Oliver and his server infrastructure for Global Rebellion talk.
Thanks. Great, very pleased to be here. Amazing environment indeed, as usual, with the CCC. First of all, I'm not at all a spokesperson for Extinction Rebellion. I do not speak for this movement called Extinction Rebellion. Whatever I say here tonight is entirely my own opinion, and so not to be taken as any overarching description of the movement more generally. What you're looking at here, of course, might seemingly be associated with this thing called Extinction Rebellion, but it is not. It is, in fact, the extinction symbol. And this is the part where, in the first half of my talk, I depress you, but then we'll go for a nice, big, sort of warm finish. The extinction symbol was, in fact, created in 2011 by a UK artist called ESP. And this entirely relates to not Extinction Rebellion, being long before Extinction Rebellion, but the fact that we have entered the sixth mass extinction on this planet that we are on. And this is became practically scientific consensus in 2015, where it has been fairly surely asserted and since reasserted that we have in fact entered the largest extinction event on this planet in 65 million years. Global populations of fish, birds, mammals, down by about 60% in 42 years. And according to the WWF a few years ago. The UN puts it at about 150 species lost per day. Now, that's a little bit more than the father of biodiversity, E.O. Wilson, that says it's around about 27,000 a year. In other words, one species lost every 19 minutes. But what does that really mean? Well, when we're talking about background extinction rates, we're looking at the background extinction rate for the last 65 million years has been about 1 to 5 species a year. So not 150 a day, but 1 to 5 a year. This is fairly conclusive of the fact that we have entered the sixth extinction on this planet. Here in Germany, for instance, just a couple of years ago, There was this Dutch-German study done that now reflects pretty much the state of the entire European continent. Three quarters of all flying insect biomass dropping in about 25 years. So three quarters less flying insects in 25 years. It's supposedly dropping at around about 2.5 a year. Now, we need insects much more than they need us. They are the glue layer of our food system, but within the planetary boundary and biological sense, they are absolutely intrinsic. They also keep much of our water very fresh. As one biologist put it, we humans will never see the end of the insects. We need them that much. Now, climate change has become very much ascribed to this this loss of species, but in fact, it's not climate change that is responsible for species decline per se. The WWF's Living Planet Index attributes about 7% of species declines to warming. In fact, the real reason why we are losing so many species so quickly is because we're changing their habitats or just removing them entirely. And certainly urbanization is a part of that, and land change as a result of warming, but primarily it's because we've replaced habitats with farmland. This is, for instance, in the Amazon basin, carving into the Amazon right there just to lay down some soy livestock feed crops. And there's another view there. Now, most of that soy... all of that soy is really exported for livestock feed, mostly to Europe and to China. But getting on to the warming thing, which is obviously a massive existential threat we do all in, all face, we can safely say now that the Paris Accord has entirely failed. The warming projections presently, we're looking at about 2.8 to 3.2 by the end of the century, not including self-reinforcing feedbacks. In other words, things like permafrost melts, just releasing tons of methane into the air, or the wildfires that we've been seeing in Australia and over in California that are just sending gigatons of carbon into the air. So this is still to be seen as relatively optimistic if we're looking at current policies and where they will lead us. So that's a lot more than 1.5. I think, first of all, it's important to point out that this is actually really happening. And even if it's unimaginable and completely unacceptable that it is happening, we still need to remember that science does not need human imagination for evidence. It needs instrumentation and lots of hard work and decades of study. And it confirms that, yes, indeed, it is really happening. Technology will not save us. This is also increasingly scientific consensus. Most recently, looking at the idea that we can just simply scrub carbon out of the air, or we can, suck it out of the air in these negative emission technology vats, if you like, they're not even gigaton capable. And 29 European science academies concluded that we can absolutely not rely on NETs or negative emissions technologies to pull enough carbon out of the air at anywhere near the rate that we need it in order to save us. What do I mean by save us? Well, when I was born, it was around about 330 ppm CO2 in the atmosphere, and we're now looking at about 412 at the latest reading. This is the Keeling curve. Now, 450 ppm is seen as something of a threshold. That that probably gets us more or less near 2 degrees centigrade of warming from post-industrial levels. With a 70% probability, if we keep it under 2 degrees, in other words, 450 ppm, sorry, if we keep it under 450 ppm, then we will almost certainly manage to avoid that 2-degree threshold with a 70% probability. Just looking at ocean rise alone, this is Miami at 2 degrees, which is arguably just around the corner. This is Shanghai. I don't know if you've ever been to Shanghai. Where will all those people go, you might ask yourself? Bangkok is already underwater at this point. 2 degrees represents something else relatively significant, however. As evidenced in this fantastic paper, well, fantastic if you read this sort of stuff and don't want to drink yourself under the table, but trajectories of the Earth system in the Anthropocene suggests very strongly that it's highly likely, extremely probable, that if we cross the 2 degrees centigrade warming threshold, we will be on an autopilot to 2.5, 3 degrees, 3.5 and 4 degrees, and that's simply an unstoppable course. No amount of carbon scrubbing can possibly compete with the self-reinforcing feedbacks after that point. We're on a course to something, a very, very different planet. And just to give you a sense of what 4 degrees, for instance, would mean, should we ever get there, which it looks like we will before the end of the century if we continue business as usual, the temperature rise from the last, from the Ice Age, the end of the Ice Age, about 10,000 years ago, to 1850 was 4 degrees of warming. Now that's 10,000 years of time for organisms, including us, to evolve and adapt to that warming. We're looking at the same amount of warming in just 150 years. There's no time to adapt. This picture I've tweeted a bit, I suppose, but maybe too much, but this was done for The New Scientist, a visualization of what the Earth would look like, what the world would look like at 4 degrees. Now, middle and southern Europe have obviously entirely gone. North America, Africa, South America, and Asia, they've all gone. I mean, where would those people go? Obviously, they'll head north. The States will move in from a geostrategic perspective. It would obviously move in to Canada, China, into Russia. There's been a lot of talk about as to what that would mean for human populations and human population numbers. And of course, you read some wild stuff. How can we possibly know? But this chap, who's had his name on 120 papers or something like this, he's one of the most highly regarded atmospheric scientists in the world, cited over 1,000 times across academic journals in the domain of atmospheric science, believes it's just a few thousand people. The carrying capacity of the Earth is just a few thousand people seeking refuge in the Arctic or Antarctica. And of course, all the way to 4 degrees, we have war. We have resource depletion, driving conflicts. We have mass migration. And very unfortunately, it is fairly safe to conclude that children alive today will, even though it's still, again, relatively unimaginable, but based on our best available information, very probably face mass migration, war, and hunger, should we not turn things around. This is just simply the way it is. This is where we are going. But surely governments would never let that happen. You hear that a lot. But the thing is, they have let that happen, and they are continuing to let that happen. Appropriate response, I suppose, to all that. This UK artist, pop artist, sort of experimental pop stuff, said this. I wrote this down on a napkin one day. I really like it. Hope without honesty is denial, because people reach for hope at these times. But also really like Kate Marvel, climate scientist. She said that we don't need hope. We need courage. Courage is the resolve to do well without the assurance of a happy ending. This is more where we need to be going. Banksy, of course, giving us a bit of a hand here with this. From this moment, despair ends and tactics begin. In truth, there's no hope without action. This is really where we stand. And this is not just my opinion. It happens to be an opinion very widely spread. In fact, the world scientists, in their A Second Warning to Humanity, very recently wrote that that same thing. They said that with a groundswell of organized grassroots efforts, dogged opposition can be overcome and political leaders compelled to do the right thing. Now that is 15,364 scientists from 184 countries. It's the most signed scientific document in all history. They are urging us in the absolute ineptitude and lack of engagement from governments to actually rise up and force governments to act. That's what they're telling us to do. And you can look at this as a bit like, you know, imagine you have a disease, a very rare disease, and that the world's expert, you know, those scientists, 15,364 scientists, contains most of the world's Nobel laureates, planetary boundary scientists, food system scientists, geologists, biologists. They say that, you know, so from the perspective of expert opinion, it doesn't get much better. You can imagine that, yeah, you have a disease that very few people have, and the world's expert says to you, listen, it's really grim. You are looking at a particularly bleak end. an ugly end, unless, of course, you stop now doing these things. You can also think that where our space habitat has a variety of subsystems. It has a freshwater subsystem, you know, that looks at water purification and filtration, thermal regulation subsystem. You can look at food pods. They are being attacked on our space habitat. If you don't like the word environment or Earth, you think it's a bit too kind of patchouli-dosed or hippie, then think of it this way, because that is what's happening. What they're telling us is that it's time to rebel. It's time to force governments to act, because they are not acting. No more business as usual. What we need is massive, swarming, non-violent, uncontainable civil disobedience en masse. Civil disobedience, unlike protests where you just get out on the street and little, marqueed, area with your little police permit for the protest, holding little signs, oi, 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 civil disobedience actually works. It has provably worked. South Africa versus apartheid, India versus the British Raj, US civil rights movement, the Velvet Revolution. It's the way to go. Now, Extinction Rebellion is very much a manifestation of that energy. The idea of actually channeling civil disobedience to the ends of driving change is very much what it's about. It's the kernel of the movement. It started on October the 31st, where a bunch of British activists marched onto Parliament Square and declared rebellion against the British government for its lack of action on the climate and ecological emergency. And then soon afterwards, 6,000 or so descended upon London and effectively shut down the city centre by occupying five bridges. Extinction Rebellion is a leaderless... That's very important. I mean, the press have always reaches for a figurehead, but it is very much a leaderless... it is not steered by the UK, decentralised international apolitical network using non-violent direct action and civil disobedience to persuade governments to act justly on the climate and ecological emergency. I'm just going to show a couple of videos right now to just give you a sense of the kind of what civil disobedience in this case actually comprises. I'll show you a video from France, particularly focused on overconsumption. We're talking about resource depletion here in the CCC this year, which I think is great. And this was a protest at Block Friday instead of Black Friday, which is, of course, a mass consumerist event. Here we go. They occupied a shopping mall for 7 hours and a whole bunch of stores across the country, Apple Store, etc. Just fantastic stuff. And you might think, where is this going? Well, and is that really the only approach, you know, occupying malls and shops, etc., etc.? I'll show you another video for a very different strategy. This is Extinction Rebellion New York City occupying Times Square. And I think this is definitely a... What is the video called? That's right. Player... Sorry, it's a bit cut off, isn't it? Again. Oh, well, whatever.
Is the only serious option we have to make a very